So this is the second episode of Talk About and Find Out with Gabriel Zito. Firstly, how are you doing? How's your day been?
Doing really well. I've just been coding a lot. It's like most of my days, but it's fun.
Fair enough.
And yeah, I love it.
Is that is so that's what most of your time is taken up with, it's just coding then.
It's like, so normally in the morning I try to have deep work. So it's like I focus the most, lock in, and then I put calls in the afternoon where my brain's less awake, videos and social media and stuff late at night. Yeah.
Well, we will definitely touch on A Map of Us, which is what I'm assuming the coding you're referencing is about. But let's
Yeah.
start. We'll do this chronologically. So we knew each other at school, and yeah, I don't think we've spoken since we both left school. So if you want to just give like a very brief career slash life path since going to uni, basically.
Yeah, of course. I mean, well, so Sasha and I knew each other. Well, I guess you knew me. We knew each other when we were like 18-ish, and then I went to UCL. So same city as Sasha, but just a different uni. And I was majoring in economics because I wanted to be like a finance bro or like work in finance. But as I did my course, like in my second year, I was like, this ain't it, the internship grind and all this. Like, I don't, like, that's just not for me personally. And I decided to like start coding. I did like the stupid intro to programming course, and I was like, oh my God, I love this so much more. And then I pretty much like self-taught myself how to code. I think on the first episode of Sasha's thing was a guy called Leon, and I was working with, taught me the basics.
So you mentioned it earlier. We obviously both went to university in London, so we can start there. It's obviously different to like the traditional UK university experience. How did you find being a university student in the big city of London?
Yeah, so I guess compared to other unis like Durham or like college, I mean, sorry, campus unis, I like just the freedom of London. But I'm not sure. I think I just liked it because I'm a city person. Get to meet like people from all of the other unis.
We were both in the town for school as well, so I feel like it was nice. It was nice to be in a bigger city. And then obviously sort of going into economics at UCL, and you were kind of touching it on there earlier that you what you really were interested in and what you're studying changed as you went through your degree. My understanding of your course is that in the third year, it's optional to take a dissertation, but you could also potentially do some big like individual projects. So I was just wondering whether that like shift to coding, did that manifest itself in that final project you did in third year?
While saying coding manifested itself in the way that I just spent way too much time there, so I just didn't end up getting a first in my final year, which was which was fine. But I did my last year project on, so I didn't do a dissertation, but I wrote like about the history of Rwandan economy, the genocide and how it affected the economy. So yeah, very different, but I didn't reapply my coding into my degree much. It was like two separate paths, but they complement each other.
I guess was there ever the possibility that they could like come together, or was that like a very deliberate thing from you to have coding and degree separate?
I think going out into the real world, having both coding and an econ degree or understanding like business itself is like a very good match to have. Yeah, business and code.
That obviously wasn't quite the plan when you first came to university, but by the end of it, you were very certain that actually coding is a really important thing that you need to have a grip of going forward.
Yeah, I think so. At least, I don't know, I have a mindset that we're entering this world which is full of like AI and automation and tech, and if you don't know how to code or at least understand code, then you'll be left behind. I don't know how true that is. That's just my opinion.
No, we will see. So talking about the real world, so you had an internship at Athena Lab. You go, I did a quick check of the website, and my understanding is a shared knowledge base for teachers, or
Yeah.
I think it said a global department office, which was a pretty effective marketing piece of slang. But could you give maybe a little bit more information about what Athena Lab is and how that internship came about as well?
Yeah, I think they took a pause, maybe 8 months after the summer that I worked there, just because of some funding reasons. It was hard to get started, but they were a startup, just two people, two guys, amazing, amazing people. And I wanted to work for a small startup, or I just always like small startups anyways, because I would be able to work with the founder or whoever's me like one-on-one, and I get to learn the most. And so his name was Peter, and yeah, he Athena was trying to, how to explain this? Like, say if a teacher in UCL had like was the best in their course, like did the best lecture on, I don't know, history in the 1990s, and another uni professor like Glasgow was doing that same lecture. There was no centralized space where like these teachers could share materials, at this high level where like, you know, this is my lecture for and the teacher's materials for it. So they provided the space, or were trying to provide space where all these teachers all around the globe could, yeah, essentially share how they teach, which I think was a very good mission.
Let's start with just what made you apply, I suppose, because it sounds like an interesting idea. But obviously, you mentioned like working in a startup. Was it you just applying to any startup, and that happened to be the one, or was there something about education that you found interesting?
Yeah, I always wanted to help the world, which is part of the reason why I didn't go into finance. Because while applying, I was like, why am I even applying to this? I want to do something that's more meaningful. So I applied to edtech and like sort of environment technology as well. I sadly didn't get any in the environment tech. But yeah, I applied to edtech because I think education is just like a huge part of learning. It's like one of the best things about humans and one of the best fields you go into. Like, it's genuinely helpful. I actually cold emailed, and yeah, just if you cold email like a bunch of startups, one of them will probably reply to you rather than going through this huge like internship application process.
Yeah, I guess so. And well, it's clear that it does work. And you went proper startup, like early
Yeah.
stage as well. So, in terms of what you did there, I'm gonna test your LinkedIn profile here. My understanding is you started developing skills with Notion there.
I hope it's on my LinkedIn. I'm not actually sure, but one of the main things I did was like deal with the ecosystem of the space. So I was looking at like what AI tools were out there already that were in this sort of space, and like what were they doing correct, and what were they not doing correct, and how essentially gain research so that Peter could like have a better vision of the product market fit and where the future of Athena was going to go. And that was all done in Notion, which is like, if you don't know, it's sort of like everything, but we use it as like a relational-ish database.
My previous workplace used Notion, and I still use it as well today. So you're essentially doing, I suppose, just like, would you call it market analysis, and then using Notion to help present it to your other co-workers?
Yeah, exactly. Market analysis and yeah, research. Yeah. There was another big thing. And
Oh, go on
then
then.
so that was half of it, and then the other half was I applied to grants. So I helped set up grants and yeah, get some funding sorted.
Was
So
that a process that you tried to automate, or was that just cold emailing and human perseverance?
that was more human perseverance. I should have probably done automation, but I didn't quite do that. Manual hard, like just typing stuff up.
Well, I
Looking
can
back, I
imagine.
should have automated it.
Yeah, I wonder whether in that ed tech space sometimes the human connection might go a little bit further than automated messages. But yeah, so this was between first year and second year at university, or was this second year and third year?
This was second year and third year,
Okay, nice.
I
And
think.
it seems that now you were already on the path away from the finance bro and towards the founding for meaningful good pathway.
That was like when I first started just coding some very, very basic apps compared to Emu. And yeah, actually, that's wild. That was like 2 years ago. Mad.
You just mentioned there that you were starting to code apps on the side as well, outside of Emu, obviously. Is there anything that's survived, or anything that you'd any app that you're particularly proud of?
Well, I'm proud of them, but I think that they're particularly like amazing. They aren't, but
Okay,
I
just the
have like my
process
core.
of, yeah.
They're mostly just like little games for fun and like just my portfolio.
And that portfolio then led you to part-time work with Assembly GTM. Is that correct?
No, I actually got that through a very, very weird connection.
Okay.
So like I actually went I go climbing, like indoor bouldering,
Yep.
and
Okay.
I like met a guy there who was like a bit older than me, and one of his friends, so it was like a friend's friend will start for you. And so this friend's friend, I asked if I could work for him, and that's how I ended up working at Assembly. So
That's crazy.
it's like nothing to do with portfolio. It was literally just a human talking. This was just a random morning, like 10
Yeah.
a.m. I just went to the gym and made a mate.
That's crazy. I
So,
mean, it,
yeah,
yeah.
very out of the blue.
Goes to show, though, how like things can randomly happen. Sometimes there's
Yeah.
no grand plan, I guess. Yeah,
It
it
goes to show how
seems.
many software engineers climb.
It seems to me your time at Assembly GTM was more about developing like CRM expertise. Is that correct?
So that was like the first software engineering role. And like at this point, I just had an econ degree, and then I guess I'd worked on all these other projects, and I sort of told the guy like, I can get it done, and he was like, okay, sure. And there wasn't like much to back it apart from what I'd built already. But yeah, I worked in CRM related stuff. You don't know what that is. It's like consumer. It's like on the sales side, so we were dealing with building like sales pipelines, database integrations, just kind of boring work, but I found it really fun.
Well, my impression, at least for it, because I did a bit of CRM stuff at Entrepreneurs First as well, is that it's boring, but it's also really important.
It
So,
is very important, yeah.
yeah, unfortunately, well, I'd be curious to get your opinion on this. Entrepreneurs First was set up on Salesforce, but for I can already see you grimacing a little bit. But it seems to me that Assembly GTM works more with Atio. How would you compare Atio to Salesforce, and is it worth the hype? Because I feel like there is a lot of hype around Atio.
Yeah, well, I like Atio because it's a UK-based company, which gives it, better standing in
Yeah.
my head. Atio is quite modern. It's built really well. I think Salesforce is a bit old, more old school. And I honestly never tried Salesforce. So like Atio was the only CRM I actually used. But I do know like Salesforce existed, but I never tried it out. But I would assume
Yeah.
that the UI is just better for Atio.
I'm sort of the
And it's
opposite
more
of you.
modern.
Yeah, I've never used Atio, but I've used Salesforce, and the UI is definitely difficult. Were you involved at all on the granola project at Assembly GTM?
So I dealt with like database related stuff to try and increase sales. Yeah, without going into too much detail. But yeah, just basic CRM stuff and like working in their ATIO, creating objects and whatnot, workflows.
So I saw that Atio was used, but there were also two softwares that I don't recognize, one called Polytomic and one called Clay. I was wondering whether you could give a little bit more insight into what those softwares are.
Let's start with Polytomic because it'll make more sense. So Polytomic is sort of like a middleman. If there's always like a database, and then somewhere there's a CRM. Essentially, Polytomic's the middleman between those two things. So it's like, how do you get stuff from a database? It's actually called a data warehouse, but think of that as like a bunch of databases. How do you get what you need from there into your CRM? And that's essentially what Polytomic is, and they do it really well. Without going into too much technical detail, that's what it is. And then Clay has some really cool things it can do. It's like a big no code tool. So you can use their Clayagent, which is like the biggest thing, so like a Clay agent, and pretty much do anything you want. So for example, you can rank like tiers for like leads.
Obviously, like Granola is a very big company, and that's a very exciting project to work on. You mentioned this earlier. Obviously, Athena Lab, you only had two other employees, and then my understanding is Assembly GTM is not a particularly big company either. How useful do you think it was to work in these smaller workplaces, especially at the start of your career, in terms of picking up skills and responsibility as well?
I would say it's probably the best decision you can make because, well, if you have a good startup, then you get a lot of responsibility. So you don't necessarily have one task, or maybe you have like one big task, which is like solve this problem for Granola. But in solving that problem, you have like so many skills you have to know. So you have to know how to deal with databases, the CRM, you need to know how to write your own code, like deploy your own code, and like deal with marketing as well, and like sales, how to talk to people. So I think it allows you to understand what you like and don't like about real life work. So, and I think that's very valuable at the start of your career.
Would your advice for people looking for early career opportunities, would your advice be to look for those, small startups rather than, I don't know, these big company internship programs?
I would say to find an internship that gives you like a broad range of responsibilities and isn't just one thing. So like don't go too narrow at the start because obviously you lock yourself in for like 5 weeks doing something you might just hate. And like you don't want to just be plugging in that Excel all the time if you end up hating it after like 1 week. So having this diverse range is good before you like to figure out what you like and what you don't like.
I suppose that takes us to graduation, at which point you very much like coding, and startup culture, which leads us to a map of us. Before I ask you any questions, let me firstly like congratulate you on what is both and like an amazing idea, also just like really well executed. I thought the UI was so clean. And yeah, I spent
Cheers.
a couple of hours last night just clicking the shuffle button, and I honestly it is insane. Like it's a truly international project. Like I went to every single part of the world, genuinely. So yeah, firstly, congratulations. I think it's really impressive.
Oh, thanks, Sasha. Yeah, it's I had the idea like in June last year, and then but I went traveling over the summer, so I didn't work on it then. But I was like, dude, I have to make this. I just have to make it happen. It's very difficult. There's like so many challenges, but I like no one else is gonna do it because so I'm gonna do it. That's what I thought.
Let's start with the origin then. You don't have to delve into this, but my understanding was there was some sort of heartbreak, and A Map of Us was a sort of a response to that, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess it's for like, so what's my elevator pitch? It's if you have something that you want to say to the world, but you don't want everyone to know about it. So things are like too private for social media, but too public to live in your own diary. Where do you put those memories? And it's like you can't really put them anywhere. It doesn't exist. Like, and that was the entire thing. I was like, where do we put these memories that live in this weird space where we might be too embarrassed to tell our friends, but they're so meaningful to us? And like, we want to tell the world, but not our friends, pretty much that. And so I decided to just like put all of these things on the map, share it with the world. And then all of a sudden, it seems like everyone has this, like, wants to do this too.
Yes, I suppose to give a little bit of context to the listener, each memory is then coded so that, like, color coded so that one is for the memory maker themselves, one is for somebody else, and then there was a third category, wasn't there?
Yeah, there's like four. So it's either for yourself, for like someone else, for everyone, or it's like a reflection. It's like four simple categories for everything.
Do you find the memories, the sort of tone and subject of the memories changing quite a lot between those different categories?
Yeah, like people post about everything, like heartbreak, memories, something about other people passing, like who have passed away in their lives. It's just all like very raw and human. Yeah, there isn't like one single thing. I don't think you can say that there's one memory because that's just entirely not true. And if you go on the website and you just like literally click around anywhere, they're all like slightly different and about things.
There was one just up the Black Sea coast from where I am in Georgia, and it was a memory for the memory person themselves. And it just said surrounded by butterflies. And then we were out for a
No.
walk. We were out for a walk today, and I saw some butterflies. And yeah, it just made me think of the memory. There are some light-hearted ones there. On the flip side, do you find it difficult to sort of process those memories that tend to delve on darker topics? So I suppose
Yeah.
to simplify my question, do you think A Map of Us is better with the filter or without the filter?
Yeah, wait, so before I answer that, like the entire bit of moderation is probably the biggest challenge in the entirety of Amu. Because it's really the only bit that deals with like not a technical challenge, but a human challenge. And it's not solvable. Like as in the biggest billionaire companies don't solve it. They haven't solved it. So going back, like what that means is that humans have to moderate things. AI can only do so much. And I would say that having, like, I have to moderate memories. Some are like just too bad to even put in like the unfiltered bit, which are like either very triggering content, or like pure harassment or just like trolls. There's a lot more, but I would say that the unfiltered mode is like if you want to cry or like if you just want to feel a bit more of what humans actually are, then you turn that on. And yeah, or well, turn off. Yeah. It's a better representation of the world, I think.
You're in a really interesting position where you seem to have a clue of how people all over the world feel. Outside of the UK, has there been memories from one specific country that you relate to the most?
I actually don't think so, which is like a good thing in the sense that like everywhere globally are people who have loved or like are loving and like feel so much that they want to put it out into a map. And so like no particular country sticks out that much, but I would say like the Philippines has the largest amount of these memories. And so I think there are a lot of like Yanas over there.
And I suppose this growth all around the world, this was like completely organic, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think I'm in a very privileged position where I know that if I do keep posting, eventually it will go viral. And but when that happens, it will just drive up my costs. And so I'm like not doing that quite yet. But yeah, it's all organic. There's not like a single dollar spent on marketing.
And I saw again, I saw on the social media that there's now over 3,000 users. How many actual specific memories are there on the map? Do you have a number for that?
Yeah, that's pretty old. There's now 30,000.
Okay, never mind.
Yeah, so it's like it's yeah, there's quite a lot. There are around 80,000 memories.
80,000
So
memories. Okay.
yeah. But not every one of those users like have posted, and not everyone who's posted is a user, which is kind of weird because there's like anonymous posting.
Those
If that
numbers are
makes
really big. And you said earlier that the costs are becoming a little bit of a factor. Where are you storing all this
Yeah.
data? Are you using Superbase or like a different platform?
Yeah, I'm using Superbase actually, and I can go through my tech stack if you want. It's Superbase and Redis in like the back end
Okay.
for like database and stuff. Then I use Flask and Cloudflare for my actual back end. And then my front end's just Vite and React. And it's as simple as that. That's really it.
And that's a completely self-taught setup then that you've done there.
It is, yeah, it's self-taught. Most I think it's like a pretty traditional setup. It's not like very, very crazy or weird. It's like very beginner friendly, so yeah.
Slightly different angle with a map of us that I saw is this collaboration with Eagerly Awaiting. I don't know whether you might want to expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, there are a few collaborations that are happening like in the works right now. There's like a side of Amu that's like B2C, which is like customers, well, consumers, like singular people, and then the businesses type, which is like plays, theaters, other community groups that Amu wants to partner with. And yeah, Eagerly Waiting did like a live play where at the start of it they got like everyone in the audience to post onto Moo, and in the future, near future, there's going to be something called circles in a Moo, which is essentially like smaller spaces within a Moo. So you could have a circle for, let's say, I don't know, our school, for example, like Winchester College, and it would just be like memories from that community. And then, yeah, memories from that community. And then you could have ones for, I don't know, like LSC's university. And essentially, you have like different maps full of different memories for all of these different groups.
Yeah, maybe I didn't realize that it was actually Amu was actually a part of the performance itself. From what I saw, it seemed to also help with like developing method acting as well.
Yeah. So it was used at the start of their like play, as essentially it was like an improvisational play. So they took like a random memory from wherever it was in the world, and that'll be used as inspiration for the rest of the improvisation. So it was like the and like because Amu is like random, it's random memories from strangers, so each play I guess would be different.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds really cool, actually. This is I studied history at university, and this might be a bit of a history question. Do you ever see something like ammo being used as an archive, or I suppose a way to understand the way that people thought and acted at a certain point in time?
Yeah, exactly. So that's pretty much what Amu's philosophy is. Bits of hi was yeah, so bits of history all around the world like are remembered, but the things that are remembered are like the buildings and businesses, you know, from like old Rome or something, or like very famous people. But most of human life actually disappears. Like, you know, photos might survive, and but the things that make us human like usually vanish. So I wanted a place which exactly was like an archive where memories are like anchored permanently to the places where they happened.
Yeah.
And hopefully at some point in the future, anyone anywhere in the world can go on Amu and see what someone felt where they are standing.
Yeah.
And I think that's like very powerful.
Next steps for Amu and you yourself is to start selling this to businesses then and go a bit more B2B.
Yeah, the main monetization route. So the heart of Amu is like, I don't want to put ads on it. I don't want to. Any bit of monetization done in the wrong way will completely kill the spirit of it. And that's exactly what I don't want. So I'm trying to preserve Amu's heart. And I realized that like there's a very big, like tiny niche out there, like tourism companies, for example, or like these communities that I'm working with, like diasporas. Want a little map of like their own memories, except it's actually quite hard to build. Like, and there isn't really a SaaS, like a software as a service for this particular niche. So I'm trying to dig into that where I provide like different companies with their own little map.
Is there any specific industry that you feel would greatly benefit from this SaaS, or is it something that you see across the board?
I would say, like industry-wise, probably tourism or anything that has like a history. So not like tech, but yeah, tourism in the sense of like heritage, things to do with heritage and things that have a past. That's very broad, but I generally think anything that has a past can use a moo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I saw from the new features on Amu that you're introducing like certain paywalled elements such as like customizable accounts, I suppose. But I can see that you're still trying to keep the actual UI itself as ad-free as possible.
So I'll probably hate myself if I ever put ads on it. Or at least like very blatant ads. Like I think that's very bad. But yeah, monetizing in the consumer sense would probably go into like the path of like diaries
Yeah.
and giving like each individual user their own little map. So I think that's something like which provides real value to people and is something that's worth paying for. But that doesn't like take away from the fact that you can just drop a memory out into the public. This is more
Yeah.
like for yourself.
Coming back to the very first question of the interview, how you spend your time at the moment, it's just working on monetizing Amu to consumers, but also developing the B2B stuff as well then.
Yeah, that's the fun stuff. Yeah. That's
Okay.
the fun part. Yeah.
Do you want to touch on the not so fun stuff or?
I mean, yeah, they're all really technical. So,
Okay.
behind the scenes, like make something like this work is a lot of tech. Like how do you make a map where if someone posts something, you can see it like it almost immediately. Like, how do you get that live update to work? And that itself is like a very hard challenge to solve. Not many maps do
Yep.
it. And then, yeah, dealing with moderation is huge. Dealing with cybersecurity is huge, like people spamming and bots, and how to deal with that. Like, as Emu grows, eventually, one in every 100,000 people might be malicious, but one bad person, one bad thing can like completely ruin the vibe. So
Yeah.
there's like, that's like a lot of boring tech that I have to deal with that is invisible. No one really sees it if you're just using it
Yeah.
properly.
Are you doing a lot of the malware stuff through Cloudflare, or is that something that's more on Superbase?
Well, Superbase has like essentially very I don't know how much tech you know, but like RLS, like row level
Yeah.
security. Yeah, I use RLS. Most of my like most of the friction is in the back end. So not through Cloudflare. I mean, Cloudflare does very basic stuff against bots, but most of it, I just code myself. Yeah.
Okay. Is this sort of at least short term? I guess you can never really know long term. Is this the sort of future career path for you then?
Yeah, this is hopefully the future career path. I'm very determined to like make something happen out of it. And like, I would not want to trade this for anything else. I think it's something meaningful. It's something that I enjoy. Hopefully something that can pay the rent, and then after that, it's like I can't wish for anything more.
No, very true. Are you looking, or are you in the process of looking for funding for Amu? Is there sort of plans to expand in that way?
Yeah, there were actually some VCs and pitching that I did not get many that I wanted. It was sort of like a either they asked for too much early, and I'm like, yeah, I don't no, I'm not doing that right now. So I'm not looking for funding straight away. I'm gonna look to get revenue first, and
Okay.
then possibly when I need to like hire and really need like money then and expand, then I'll find funding. Yeah, I think it's easier to find funding with revenue than without. So yeah.
Yeah. Although in this economy, I think there are so many tech companies that are still so far away from revenue, which are able to raise so much money. But
Yeah.
we will see whether that comes crashing down. My last topic to discuss with you is a little bit more of like a philosophical one.
Oh, yeah, go on.
I recently read an article which is essentially was an analysis of music in the 2020s done by Dataphone called Music Match, and they essentially used AI to analyze the Billboard Top 100, so like the top 100 most popular songs, and put like emotion tags on the songs and see which emotions are rising in commercial music, basically.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
It is quite interesting. I don't know how accurate it is, but one thing, one specific emotion that has massively increased, is heartbreak. So in 2017, around 30% of the Billboard Top 100 was songs that reference heartbreak. And at the moment, we're at 57%. Obviously, heartbreak
Yeah.
is one of those emotions that is quite common to see on Amu. And I was just wondering whether you did, in the time that Amu has been running, have you noticed like an upwards trend for heartbreak?
Yeah, I think the way I do like my UGC or like the way I market it is very directed towards like
Yeah.
a very specific demographic, which is like someone who like has had their heart broken and like
Yeah.
wants to put something about that person on the map. Because that's essentially what I did. But now I'm trying to get it to not go in that direction. So that's partially my fault.
Yeah.
But yeah, most things are to do with heartbreak. I think when translated to English, 22% of the moves have the word like or love in it.
Yes.
Moods are the memories. They're the little dots. So around like 20% of them explicitly have something to do with love. Which I think is beautiful. Yeah.
The article made the point that so heartbreak, angst, and despair are all up, but love has always been top, and that's just been like a very steady, like consistent rate for references to love. So yeah, I suppose I
It
mean,
matches, matches.
yeah, it reflects that as well. I think that's it from me. Thank you, Gabriel, for being the second guest on Talk About and Find Out.